Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, in the wake of the Celtic Tiger, the Irish bishops and the St. Vincent de Paul Society release a new report on the plight of the poor in Ireland as the recession kicks in, and a dialogue with the Oriental Orthodox churches. It may not make news headlines, yet the journey towards reconciliation with these ancient Christian churches is picking up speed. They're among the most ancient churches in the world, founded, according to tradition, by the apostles in Egypt, Armenia, Syria, India and Ethiopia in the decades directly following Christ's death and resurrection. Yet they have not been in communion with either the Roman Catholic world or the Eastern Orthodox world since they officially severed ties in the 5th century. Hence, there is very little known about their rich heritage and traditions outside those countries where they are still based. They are, of course, the Oriental Orthodox churches, and here in the Vatican, their representatives recently spent a week working on a crucial joint statement on the nature and constitution of the Church, a document expected to be published soon by the Vatican's Council for Christian Unity, under whose auspices the meeting took place.
We think we have made significant progress in this dialogue, in coming to a mutual understanding about the nature of the Church, about authority in the Church, and the mission of the Church.
Father Mark Sheridan is rector of the Pontifical University of St. Anselm here in Rome and a member of the Mixed Commission for Theological Dialogue with the Oriental Orthodox Churches. During the meeting, he told me more about these ancient Christian communities and the recent steps that have been taken towards reunification.
The Oriental Orthodox churches are the Coptic Orthodox Church, the Syrian Orthodox Church, the Armenian Orthodox Church, and one has to mention that there are two Catholicosets in the Armenian Church, the Catholicoset of all Armenians in Echmiadzin, and the Catholicoset of Cilicia. And then there is the Church of Ethiopia, the Church of Eritrea, and the Orthodox Church in India, which is the Malankara Syrian Church and the Syrian Orthodox Church in India. And these churches together describe themselves as a family of churches. They share in common the reception of the first three councils of the Church, Nicaea, Constantinople, and Ephesus in 431. And they refer among themselves to each other as sister churches. They are in full communion with one another, but they are not in communion as a group with the Orthodox churches of the Byzantine tradition or with the Roman Catholic Church. Now, these churches conducted a dialogue as a group with the churches of the Byzantine Orthodox tradition back in 1980s and early part of the 1990s. And they reached certain agreements among themselves, but the agreements have never been fully accepted or ratified by all of the churches. In 2003, the Oriental Orthodox churches proposed to the Roman Catholic Church a similar dialogue, and a meeting was held of bishops here in Rome in 2003, at which an agenda was drawn up for the dialogue. And then subsequent to that, each side appointed members to this commission. So each of the Oriental Orthodox churches appointed two members, and then the Roman Catholic Church appointed an equal number of members.
And you've been meeting fairly regularly since then?
We have been meeting each year since then. This is now the sixth meeting of the full group. We met in Cairo in 2004. We met in Rome in 2005. We met in Holy Etchmiadzin in Armenia in 2006. And then we met in Rome again. And then last year we met in Mariat Sadnaya in Syria. And now this is the sixth meeting. And we hope in the course of this meeting to finalize a portion, we call it the first phase of a document on the nature of the church and authority in the church and the mission of the church.
So is this quite a significant breakthrough in your view in this process of reconciliation with between the Catholic Church and these ancient churches?
Well, we think we have made significant progress in this dialogue, in coming to a mutual understanding about the nature of the church, about authority in the church, and the mission of the church. In fact, we share a great deal in common in our understanding of the nature of the church, the first three councils. We agree basically about the sacramental structure of the church and about the structure of authority in the church.
You mentioned that these churches already have an agreement with the Byzantine Orthodox world. Is it fair to say that they are closer, as we stand today, much closer to the Orthodox world?
No, I would not say that. The historical separation occurred after the Council of Chalcedon in 451, which was not accepted by these churches. It never became part of its tradition for various reasons. And both the churches of the Byzantine tradition and the Roman Catholic Church, on the other hand, did accept the Council of Chalcedon. So I think it would probably not be correct to say they are closer to the Byzantine Orthodox than to the Roman Catholic Church.
How does this dialogue, though, sit alongside the dialogue with the Orthodox world? In other words, are we likely to see progress made here that will reflect on the dialogue with the Orthodox? Or, on the other hand, does this dialogue complicate the Catholic-Orthodox dialogue?
I don't think they have direct influence on each other, but there may be some indirect influence. The dialogue is not something that you can simply copy from one group to another, because it involves the engagement of the people, of the bishops, of those taking part, the actual members of the commission, and then it involves eventually the reception of what has been done among the various churches. So the process is very important. It's not just a final product, but the process itself, which is the dialogue.
We see, as you say, these theological dialogues that go on at leadership level, but significantly it's important what happens at grassroots level as well. What kind of atmosphere is there within these ancient churches with respect to ecumenical cooperation at grassroots level?
Well, I think there's a great variety, and it would be very difficult to make generalizations. I think the situation in the various churches is very similar to that in the Catholic Church. And as you mentioned at the beginning, there is very little knowledge of these churches within the Roman Catholic Church. And the same may be true of knowledge of the Roman Catholic Church within these various Oriental Orthodox churches. So there is a very important process of education, of dissemination of basic knowledge that remains to take place in all the churches.
Would you like to see more visibility, and how possibly could this be done in trying to learn more about these traditions in a mutual way?
I think there needs to be a great deal more visibility. And perhaps even the members of the commission need to engage in what we could call a kind of popularization. I myself have created a PowerPoint presentation. I gave it last week here in Rome at the Centro Pro Unione, just to basically let people know what this is all about, who takes part, what the goal is, and what we have done so far.
Thanks there to Father Mark Sheridan, Rector of the Pontifical University of St. Anselm. The meeting here in the Vatican at the end of January concluded with a papal audience during which Pope Benedict encouraged the work of the Joint Commission, saying the world needs a visible sign of the mystery of the Trinity and Incarnation manifested through the communion of the churches that make up the body of Christ.
The sixth meeting has taken important steps precisely in the study of the Church's communion. The very fact that the dialogue has continued over time and is hosted each year by one of the several churches you represent, is itself a sign of hope and encouragement. We need only cast our minds to the Middle East, from where many of you come, to see the true seeds of hope are urgently needed in a world wounded by the tragedy of division, conflict, and immense human suffering. I ask for God's blessings on you all and on the churches and the peoples you represent.
Pope Benedict's words to the Mixed Commission for Theological Dialogue with the Oriental Orthodox Churches. In the Wake of the Celtic Tiger is the title of a new publication from the Irish Bishop's Commission for Justice and Social Affairs, looking at the plight of the poor in Ireland in the context of the current global economic downturn. Against a backdrop of rising unemployment, increasing levels of personal debt, turmoil in the housing market, and a return to emigration, the report highlights the plight of the most marginalised, like the elderly, the disabled, the travellers and the rural poor, who benefited little, if at all, during the recent years of economic growth. Bishop Raymond Field heads the Commission for Justice and Social Affairs.
Our argument at the time was that while many, many people benefited during the boom years of the Celtic Tiger, there were also many who suffered as a result of it and who were poor. And as we did our thinking on this and reflection, the whole economic crisis began and the financial crisis, and we sank further and deeper, I suppose, into marginalisation, so that now we're really second last at the bottom of the scale of European countries vis-a-vis our wealth and our response. So we issued this report, having reflected upon it in conjunction with the St. Vincent de Paul Society. We were very conscious too, actually, of Pope Benedict XVI's message for World Day of Peace in 2009, which he issued on the 1st of January this year, Fighting Poverty to Build Peace, where he said, every form of externally imposed poverty has at its root a lack of respect for the transcendent dignity of the human person. Now, while he was concerned with world peace and the impact of globalization, he also acknowledged the many forms of poverty that exist in advanced wealthy societies, warning us that sooner or later, the distortions produced by unjust systems have to be paid for by everyone. And here we are, we're paying for this at the very, very moment, as our banks, one of our banks has been nationalized and job losses are increasing day by the day. Thousands of people lost their job. People are in fear of losing their homes and they're just paying their debts, paying their mortgages. So it is beginning to really bite in. And I think the Holy Father is right to bring us right back to having that respect for, as he said, the transcendent dignity of the human person. And as long as we ignore that, we're going to sink deeper and deeper into chaos and into poverty. And our argument is that we have to respect the human person, and that as governments try and shore up and respond to the financial crisis and the economic crisis, that they do not forget the human person. They do not forget the needs of the poor, and especially those who've been made poor by the recession.
Fine words and ambitious goals, but Bishop Fields says the report also makes some very practical suggestions as to how governments and policymakers can translate these ideals into action.
We did get down to very, very practical details. While we said that the needs of the most vulnerable must not be ignored, we did suggest that a national development plan for people, which would ensure a basic standard of living and access to education and healthcare by focusing on, as I quote, the development of human infrastructures in our community. That would be one thing. Certainly, we said that through taxation, the government could recoup from the private sector money that would help the poorer section. We also suggested that, and this came out very, very strong in our document, that there's need for a discussion both by government and generally around the common good. And that's one of the key messages in our document, that we look again at the common good of everyone. And if we begin to do that, we begin to address many of the gaps and the holes and the sufferings of people as a result of this slide into poverty.
Auxiliary Bishop Raymond Field of Dublin there, who heads the Bishop's Commission for Justice and Social Affairs.
So the report was attempting to suggest to the government what they might do in an effort to try and tackle these difficulties. And more importantly, I suppose, the main message that went out was saying, look, what you've got to ensure is that the people who benefit least during the period of the economic boom, indeed, who in no way contribute to the current difficulties that the country is in, are not now the ones expected to carry the greatest share of the burden as we try to improve the economy of the country.
John Monaghan is National Vice President of the Irish St. Vincent de Paul Society, a Christian voluntary organisation founded in France in 1833 to provide a vital lifeline to the poorest and most vulnerable on the margins of society. John told Emma McCarthy more about the report and the hidden face of poverty in Ireland, as well as the kind of people who are seeking help from the organisation today.
Well, let me explain it this way to you. Back, we just recently in the Vincent de Paul produced the report, our annual report for 2007, and that was a good year. And it showed that we spent 46 million. We estimate that last year, 2008, we would have spent over 50 million. And to give you some headline numbers, and then we'll talk about the people who come to the site looking for help. We had to spend over 5.3 million on food in 2007. We had to spend more than 3.5 million helping people with educational costs, and more than 3.5 million again helping people with fuel and energy bills. On top of that, we spent more than 7.8 million on general bills, just helping people cope. So they're headline issues. The greatest number, we've seen a huge increase in the number of calls for help over the past year, 2008, as the recession started to bite, and the largest single group of those would be families with children. And the items that they're looking for help most often with are food, fuel and heat, educational support, and general trying to cope and get by. So we're talking about families with children predominantly, but also older people, particularly those living alone, and then more recently, people who are often with great debt, who've suddenly found that they've lost the job and are in no way accustomed to the kind of problems that we're now experiencing. It is not in their memory, whereas older people would have been through difficult times in Ireland. So they are the constituents. That's the kind of money we're currently spending.
John, as you pointed out there, so many of these people perhaps who are calling for help now to the St. Vincent de Paul and other charitable organisations have no memory of poverty in Ireland. But poverty is no stranger to Ireland, and indeed the St. Vincent de Paul Society has long been working in Ireland. Can you just tell us, give us an example of the kind of work at a very basic level that St. Vincent de Paul does?
Right. Well, we have about 9,500 members spread throughout the 32 counties of Ireland. That's the entire Ireland, north and south. We have around about 1,300 branches or conferences, as we call them. About 1,000 of those are visiting people, members within those will be visiting people in their home. That would be the core work of the society. Going to where people are, helping them and the first thing we bring isn't money, although that we have that with us. First thing we bring to people is friendship and support. And then we try to help people to move on from where they are, to become independent, to regain their confidence. And in doing that, we then, of course, need to help them meet their bills. So provide food, bring them clothing, help children get through school, help them get back into work. But the main thing, quite apart from the financial thing, really what we see ourselves doing is bringing the message of love and hope contained in the Gospels, the writings and teaching of Frederick Osnam and Vincent de Paul, and indeed the principles of Catholic social teaching. So they're the bedrock. That's, if you like, the spiritual fuel that we use in our work. And the other work that we do, quite apart from the visitation, we are running here in Ireland, we are running about 18 hostels for homeless people. So we take about 500 people every night off the streets. We have nearly 1,000 social housing units. These are housing units for people who couldn't normally afford a house. Many of them are older people. We have quite a few youth clubs. We have family resource centres scattered throughout the country in which we run courses. We help children and parents with educational courses and a variety of other events. We visit people in prisons. We visit asylum seekers and migrant workers. We work with people in hospitals. So there's a huge range of activity. Indeed, we would estimate that our members are spending on visitation between 350,000 and 400,000 visits a year in a small country, and we're putting in between us more than 2 million free volunteering hours. So there's a lot of effort going in to try and help people. But again, to put that in perspective, we currently have nearly 300,000 people in Ireland, many of whom are children, who are living not only on very low incomes, but are deprived of basic necessities such as food, fuel, clothing, light, and so forth. And then around them again, there's nearly another 800,000 people who are deemed to be at risk of poverty. They're the people who wake up every morning hoping that the utility bill or the rent bill isn't going to be high this month, because if it is, they have a real struggle to pay for it. Hoping that a child doesn't come home from school with an invite to a birthday party, because there's no way the family can afford a birthday present for the child they're going to visit. And more importantly, there's no way that they could have a birthday party in their own home, which they might be expected to do. An awful lot of people then living on the edge. And then, of course, the group we mentioned earlier, the people who are suddenly have lost the job. And the difference now between, you mentioned earlier times of struggle and poverty in Ireland, back in the late 80s, early 90s, when things were very bad with huge inflation, huge interest rates and high unemployment, at that stage we had the safety valve of emigration. And now that the rest of the world is struggling, of course, that's no longer open to people in Ireland to go elsewhere looking for a job. But also back in the late 80s, early 90s, the level of personal debt was not as high. Whereas now, many of the people who are suddenly finding themselves out of work and who are really struggling to cope have huge personal debt, whether that be a mortgage for a home, a car that they've bought, a credit card, whatever. And they really are struggling. And I think the biggest concern we would have in the Society of Vincent de Paul is that we can continue to generate funds so that we can help those people, because we rely predominantly on donations from a very generous Irish public who themselves are struggling financially.
It is a huge organisational infrastructure that the St Vincent de Paul has up and running in Ireland. And as you said, it is completely reliant on charitable donations. How is the recession affecting you in that field, and how will you cope if you see a reduction in your donations?
Well, surprisingly enough, when we launched our annual appeal, which tends to take place around Christmas every year, we worried greatly that we would have a reduction in support. And we voiced this concern, and thankfully, the Irish public have been absolutely fantastic. The response to the appeal has been absolutely dramatic, and we've managed to get a lot more money than we thought. But I mentioned that we probably spent about 50 million in 2008. Our anticipation is that we might be anywhere between 55 to 60 million this year, and we are reliant. Our hope will be that the Irish public will continue to support. If they don't, obviously then what we can give to people will be reduced.
Taking it now perhaps to a more personal level, John, would you mind telling our listeners how you became involved in the St Vincent de Paul Society?
Well, I live in a parish in another county very close to Dublin, which is the capital of Ireland. I live in Kildare, in a place called Leixlip, and your listeners might know it as the home of Guinness. That's where Guinness was actually brewed 250 years ago for the first time. So I live in that, which is certainly when I moved out, a semi-rural parish. And I've been a member of the society now for about 25 years. I go out visiting people in their homes, helping people try to cope, advocating on their behalf and dealing with local authorities and government offices to ensure that they get whatever entitlements they're doing. And that would be typical of many of the members. In my day job, I'm a professor of mechanical engineering in Trinity College in Dublin. I'm married. I have three grown-up children. I'm currently the national vice president, which means that quite apart from my normal Vincentian work of being an ordinary member of a conference, I am also tasked with responsibility, along with the other members of the board, in trying to run a very, very large organization with as we mentioned there, 9,500 members, over 1,300 branches, lots of property that we use to help people over the country. So it is quite a daunting challenge. Having said that, I think what we're trying to do, as I mentioned earlier on, what we're really trying to do and what invigorates us is to try to live out that message of love and hope contained in the Gospels. And this is true of every member of the Society St. Vincent de Paul in Ireland, to try and look at Catholic social teaching and try to see, is there any way that we can try to bring the story of the Beatitudes, the story, I suppose one way to describe it might be, a lot of our work might appear like the story of the Good Samaritan, seeing somebody on the road, picking them up, and helping them to cope. But we take it a stage further. We have to ask the awkward question, both of government and other people here in Ireland, those who are well off, why was that person lying on the road in the first place? And more importantly, what is it that we can do to try and ensure that not so many people are left lying on the road in need? And so that's what inspires me. It's what inspires all the other members of the society.
You said there before that you've been working, you've been part of the St. Vincent de Paul Society for over 20 years. In the course of that 20 years, without naming names or giving specific details, is there only one story that for you symbolises the missionary charism of the St. Vincent de Paul Society and what it can do?
Yes, I can think back to a family that I had to deal with back in the early 90s. And it was a difficult situation. There was a mother, father, two children. The children were in many ways brighter than the parents, and I'm putting that as politest. There were difficulties with the parents. One of the young people had a speech impediment, and I was able to work with him and indeed with colleagues, and we managed to get speech therapy. We ensured that they stayed, both the boy and the girl stayed in school, because there's always a danger of those circumstances that they will leave. And he stayed in school. He went on and he moved on to third level. He then qualified as an electrical engineer. And he's now moved out and broken that cycle of poverty. And I think if I'm proudest of anything, it probably is that. And that kind of story can be repeated time and time again by members. But for me, it comes to mind straight away. It's a situation that if you stick there for the long haul, it's not a matter of simply walking in one night, giving some euro and helping people pay an ESP bill. But it's being with people. That's what I mentioned earlier. It's the offering the friendship and the support. It's being with people to help them regain their confidence so that they can fulfill their potential. And for me, that for that family, something that I feel happy about. I won't use the word proud, but I'm happy that that's happened, and I'm delighted that that family are now on a firm footing.
Thanks there to John Monaghan, National Vice President of the St. Vincent de Paul Society in Ireland, talking to my colleague Emma McCarthy. And if you're interested in supporting the organisation in any way or contacting them for help, you can find them on the web. The Irish homepage is at www.svp.ie, with links to the organisation in other European countries. And that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thank you for joining me, Philippa Hitchin. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.